Group meeting, Saturday, 9th July, 1988. I think the Bhagavad Gita is a scripture of unusual importance. It not only is a teaching of how to live the good life, the human life, but it also presents a very deep philosophy of things. You remember we have already considered one or two points in connection with this, namely that the author of the Gita is actually the teacher. This is my view. I don't know if anybody in the world will agree with that. The author of the Gita was a man who lived the truly religious life and was able to enter that transcendent holistic consciousness and also, of course, live the everyday worldly life as such. His own name was Krishna. His personal name was Krishna. And the author, in this state of transcendent consciousness, is, I consider, the teacher Krishna in the Gita. Because in the 10th discourse, verse 37, he says quite clearly, of the sons of Vrishni — Vrishni was the name of the clan to which he belonged — of the sons of Vrishni, I am Krishna. That was his personal name. Of the sons of — and you know, the Gita was supposed to be given when the great war, the Mahabharata as it is called, was held in abeyance until Krishna gave his teaching, finished giving his teaching to Arjuna. So, of the sons of Vrishni, I am Krishna. Of the sons of Pandu — the Pandavas and the Kauravas were cousins at war with each other. Of the sons of Pandu, I am Arjuna. Of seers, in silence — the word used actually is munis, it's translated as seers, but the muni is the one who has realized the state of silence, the complete, perfect silence, and can enter into it as and when he wishes. Of seers in silence, I am Vyasa. And his author of the Gita was called Krishna Dvaipayana Veda Vyasa. Last time I told you that Dvaipayana means island-born, and Veda Vyasa — Vyasa means the compiler of the knowledge. And this knowledge, of course, is not just reading, writing, arithmetic, that sort of thing, but it is the supreme spiritual knowledge. The person who can enter into holistic consciousness is credited with omniscience. But that must not be understood as omniscience of all the accumulated worldly knowledge that people have. It is in this holistic state one is actually the living God, so to say. That is why Krishna is worshipped as God incarnate. Jesus is called the Son of God. And so many of the teachers in India were called Brahmaputra, which means the son of Brahma. Brahma, the creator God. But the supreme state is the one in which there is complete silence. That means that the brain has ceased to talk. When the brain ceases talking, there are no dreams, there are no fantasies, and so on, as far as the personal life is concerned. One, of course, converses with other people because one lives in the world and moves about, and therefore there has to be conversation, and there has to be the ordinary everyday living process as such. But this silence implies, therefore, that mind in its transcendent state, I call mind that archetypal form through which the primordial creative energy expresses its creative activity. Because out of the shapeless, the formless, the ultimate, as we may say, there emerged the whole universe. And when we say universe here and now, in our day and age, people think in terms of the cosmos, all the galaxies and the stars and etc., etc. But I would say that possibly, and perhaps even probably, that primordial creative energy, once it started, once it received that stir for movement, for manifestation, may have brought into being several grades of being of which we are completely and totally unaware. We don't know. We have this tradition in all the religious scriptures, all of them, of archangels, angels, and the whole heavenly host, as it is called. But this heavenly host may represent some of those grades created by the action in eternity of the primordial creative energy. They may represent that. And the human being, you or I, if and when we are able to enter that silence through realizing holistic consciousness, contact those grades of being, those transcendent grades. And we give them names. See, this is man's inveterate habit. Whatsoever he comes across, he has to name it. But of course it's a necessity too, because without naming it, you can't convey it to anybody else or pursue the research into it without naming it. So now, Vedavyasa was the compiler of this transcendent knowledge which you are capable of receiving, experiencing in a transcendent state, not in any sort of human state, which means through sense perception and through imagination and so forth. But in a transcendent state, you are capable of experiencing it, and you are in touch. As long as you remain in that state of holistic consciousness, you are in touch with something which is utterly beyond this world. So, now of course, for people like myself, it seems to us that that is what all manifestation is evolving towards. This primordial creative energy and the transcendent consciousness which is involved with it. Human beings have done it, and they have taught accordingly. Those who were interested. One can't force these things down anybody. If a person is interested, if he has this kind of divine curiosity, very well, you can try to communicate it to him, you see, in ordinary language. But of course, ordinary language fails hopelessly to convey that whose context is infinite and eternal. Because our context, which we cannot escape as long as we are what we are, our context is finite and temporal. It is the mortal context. The other is the immortal context. It was never born. It had no beginning. It has no proceeding, no developing. We develop. That which is mortal and finite and temporal can develop, but that which is immortal, infinite and eternal cannot develop. It has no meaning there in that transcendent context. If a person were to ask me, well, can you give any example, can you give any evidence of it? It's quite impossible to give any evidence. I can only say that, and this happened around about 1978, 1979, it just suddenly came to me like that. And and it took an expression in thought and words in the manner in which I'm trying to put before people. You see, there's no proof whatsoever for it. Proof doesn't belong to that which transcends the manifested world. In the manifested world, you can have proof. And remember that every proving needs an assumption of certain self-evident axioms, your data with which you start. Like in geometry, given this, that and the other, the data, prove that so and so is the case. It's like that. And you know, Plato used the phrase, God geometrizes. It's very interesting. Now, God in manifestation, of course, geometrizes. but in the in God's own godly transcendent state, there is no geometry at all. At least I think not, because it would make eternity and infinity meaningless. Now, Krishna teaches, he who serves me unfailingly by the yoga of devotion, he crossing beyond the qualities. You know, you understand what the qualities are. Sattva, Rajas and Tamas. Sattva, the perfect, the truth, the transcendent, so to say. Rajas is movement, action, and movement starts disturbance in that supreme, in that peace of God which passes understanding and which is ineffable, is disturbed by manifestation. And in manifestation, therefore, you must get duality and multiplicity also, and all sorts of problems and oppositions and all that sort of thing. So that's Rajas. It's the Rajasic quality. And then there is Tamas, the dark quality, the quality of inertia, the quality of unknowingness. Remember that the word consciousness means the faculty of knowingness which we have. The faculty of knowingness. Don't associate that just exclusively with knowledge in our ordinary sense. How to cook, how to get to the West End, all the countless things of which we have a knowledge, as we say, academic, practical, intellectual, anything, whatever it may be. It's not just that. It's the faculty of knowingness, the possibility of the holistic state. That is consciousness. And the culmination of consciousness, so that is why in the culmination of consciousness for us human beings is, I say, this holistic consciousness. It's that kind of consciousness. What sort of a world can you imagine it would be if a reasonable number of human beings realized holistic consciousness? There are more than 5,000 million people in the world today. We passed that limit in the 1970s, the late 1970s. 5,000 million people who can be gods walking on the earth. It's an extraordinary thing. But of course it's overwhelming, because we naturally ask, when, oh when? No, it's not like the lovers who say, oh, let's get married tomorrow. This divine marriage, this divine fulfillment will take all of time to work itself out. And time itself will die into eternity. Because that is what holistic consciousness functions in eternity. So Krishna says, by the yoga of devotion, crossing beyond the qualities, this tamasic, rajas, sattva, rajas and tamas. And Krishna declares, whoever does that is fit for emerging into Brahman, the absolute all. Well, transcendence, that's what it comes to. And he declares, when he truly sees all apparently separate existing beings as rooted in and proliferating out of the One, he becomes Brahman. Now, people have talked about the caste system of India. And the caste system has four main divisions. And there are hundreds of subdivisions. Four main divisions. The Brahman, the Kshatriya. The Brahman is the sage, the saint, the teacher. The Kshatriya is the ruler, the lawgiver, the soldier, the protector, and so forth. The Vaishya is the merchant class, generally speaking, as such. His business is to accumulate wealth, but this is where Western scholars, on the whole, have failed to notice one particularly important point about this accumulation of wealth by the Vaishya class, the merchant caste. And that is that you accumulate wealth for the use of humanity. And they say distinctly, you put aside this proportion for promoting your business, you put aside this proportion for your own use and development and your families, and the rest is for the whole community. And this has been historically observed in various reigns, particularly, for instance, because this is written by British historians, that in the reign of Harshavardhana, who was a contemporary of Muhammad and Li Shi Min in China. You see, whenever famine or anything broke out, the king's granaries were thrown open. And so on, you see, things like that. And in both Chinese and in Indian history, the Wellingtons and Nelsons and Alexanders and Napoleons were more or less poo-pooed. It was just a line that he reigned so many years, that's all. But if anybody built a bridge which promoted the welfare of the villagers, then his name was certainly recorded as a great name historically. I mean, things like that. A different outlook on life altogether. I think India, at least partially, well deserved to be called a spiritually minded country. Because they were concerned with human beings and human affairs as such, and human welfare in the supreme sense, the physical sense as well as the transcendent sense. So, he becomes a Brahman. And in the Vajrasuchi Upanishad, it is distinctly stated that the word Brahman does not apply just to a person who is born of Brahman parents. The Brahman father and the Brahmini, that's the feminine wife, mother, you see. Not just that, but he who has realized Brahman is the one who can rightly be called a Brahman. I can show it to you in black and white. It's in one of the so-called minor Upanishads, the Vajrasuchi Upanishad. Vajra means thunderbolt, and Suchi means needle. Interesting, that word. I don't know whether the name Vajrasuchi as applied to the Upanishad is derived and can be looked at that way. I'm not certain about that. Now, he who serves me, the revealed as well as the inexpressible one reality. Remember the words of Jesus, no man cometh unto the Father but through me. It's very, very significant, isn't it? What is this me? The revealed as well as the inexpressible. Whoso is aflame with the pure passion for me is fit for emergence into transcendence. Evolution and all that is out of transcendence. But then comes the emergence, the return journey. This pure passion which lights up the night and shines through the day is man's love divinized. This is bhakti. The word bhakti means devotion. This pure passion which lights up the night and shines through the day is man's love divinized. This is, of course, my commentary. The qualities sattva, rajas and tamas are the threads with which the web of bonded existence is woven by you, by me. Love divinized unweaves the web, and you and I, made pure, are ready for the freedom of the unconditioned. Bhakti, that is devotion, has a twin, jnana, knowledge. The pure awareness which is being, transcendent being, that is jnana. Whoso is quite purified, in whom love divinized burns steady and bright, who truly sees and who knows with the knowing which is being that the many are the one only, he truly becomes Brahman. You know, the old Indian seers and sages openly said, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. And I think after the meeting, I'll try and confirm it. It comes in the Areopagite's writings. I think St. Bernard was one who talked about deification, which of course the Catholic Church frowned upon altogether. Man can never be deified. Only Jesus was the Son of God. That's all. Now, I said, and who knows with the knowing which is being. I think you have heard me use that phrase. You know by being what you know. You know, Plato said, a man really knows something if he can do it. But to know the transcendent, to know God, you have to be the transcendent, you have to be God. So that's what I mean when I say knowing by being. And that knowing by being emerges in your consciousness as and when the brain can stop talking. How do you stop the brain from talking? Don't stop it. Don't try to stop it. Let it stop. It will stop by itself. You see, whenever you have truly loved, love transcendentally, you are speechless. You can use certain words, I adore you, my darling, or this, that, or the other. You can use certain words like that. But actually you feel speechless when this actuality of love in its real loveness is functioning through you. Then you are love. Timelessly, the veiling mists obscuring the perfect holy union of transcendence, heaven and earth have vanished for the time being. When the breath of grace is stilled, for none may take that air too long, then again sattva and rajas and tamas impose their disequilibrating activity upon the still one, the silent one. And the Brahman constricts again into a seeing subject, observing objects. And so, once again, he's out of the state of unity, out of the state of perfect love. I remember how paragraphs like this sort of came to me. Many of them came sitting under the apple tree, with the sun shining, of course. That indestructible unmanifest, the last born, reaching which there is no return, is my supreme abode, says Krishna. And he also says, I, Purushottama, the ultimate person, Purushottama, is Purusha Uttama. Uttama means the ultimate, the supreme. Purusha is the person. And when our English word person is translated as the Sanskrit Purusha, it means he who has burnt out all evil. That is the meaning of the word Purusha. And it is the way it is explained in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. First chapter, fourth section, first verse and paragraph. (Clears throat) And he says, I, Purushottama, am the abode of Brahman. Brahman, the indestructible, unmanifest, the non-finite, the immeasurable, the absolute. How can this be? I'm asking the question when I wrote this. How can each be the abode of the other? It is so. Realization is in the living content of man's actual experiencing. It is the plenitude beyond count. That means beyond measurement. Comprehension of this by him in whom evil-mindedness is burnt out is of the nature of attuned vibration, not distorting the truth. But it cannot definitely grasp and so limit whole reality. Clearly, realization is beyond explanation. Yet it has a core of strange logic in the comprehension, or else comprehension and realization would each be separate forever in lone darkness. This logic makes paradox true. It is actually illogical. It's neither logical nor illogical. It cannot be argued about. It cannot be expounded in a thesis and so forth. It is illogical. Self-evident truth. And this logic has the elasticity of the living, whereas the purely formal verbal structure has the rigidity of the inanimate. And then I say, each to its own place. Because this illogical belongs to you and functions through you in your state of transcendent consciousness, which is transcendent love, transcendent wisdom, perfect purity, and so on. And the ordinary logic that we know of and deal with, the logic of the brain and the sense functions, is the logic which belongs to the mortal, to the manifest. And each has its place. Vedavyasa knew all this. So he spoke inspiring words, magical words, about the numinous and the unknown in both its aspects. That which comes to one in the condition of revelation, the I am state, when Arjuna is wrapped, R-A-P-T, wrapped into Krishna. And that which remains the unknowable, the transcendent mystery. And he also knew this truth about himself, the man in the world, in relation to transcendence, namely, the truth that is fully told in the words, I do not know. If anybody says, and he speaks quite honestly and truly, I do not know, as Socrates did, then the man in the world is speaking in relation to transcendence. And he can be listened to. If I can confess quite honestly, I do not know, I am beyond the conflict between pride and humility, between conceit and modesty. I am truly meek. You know the meaning of the word meek. It comes from the Greek praos. And to be meek means to be tamed and trained. The Greeks use the word praos And in the Greek version of the Bible, the word is praos. Blessed are the meek, praos is the word. They use the word praos in connection with a colt or an ass which had not been tamed and trained. And the process of taming and training was the process of praos, of being meeked. And then the colt or the ass was your good servant. So the psychophysical organism is the colt. And this psychophysical organism has to be meeked, praos, tamed and trained. And you tame it and train it not in the usual way that the ignorant masses tame and train. We have a saying in Gujarati, Teji ne tukaro, gadara ne dafena. To the teji, that means the intelligent one, referring to the horse, just crack of the whip in the air, that's all. Teji ne tukaro, gadara, to a mule, dafena, you belabor him. You get it? It's like that. So, the right way to tame and train is only, the one and only way, is the way of love and understanding, patience, forbearance, and the being the living example. You know, I dedicated my book Zarathustra to my father and my mother. And to my father, and I've put, and underneath were the everlasting arms. I experienced that in my father. He never even spoke a harsh word to me, leave alone hurt me in any way. Absolutely extraordinary. So that is the way to tame and train. Where are we? Yes. When I, contained here and now by Mother Earth, chastened, can say with the simple assurance of the innocent, I do not know, my heart is freed of heaviness, tamas, inertia, darkness, and Mother Earth takes me into the land of light, sattva, and lays me at the foot of the holy, at the feet of the holy. Then only I, the Son of Man, grow into my full manhood, manhood with a capital M. And when the wisdom love of my Father God overfills my heart and radiates into His kingdom, the universal glory of the one transcendent real, then transcendence has blazed into self-awareness through me. See, each one of us has to become the vessel, the instrument, through whom transcendence manifests its own transcendence. If one can see that, even intellectually, really see it, one gets free of the conflict between conceit and modesty, between pride and all that sort of thing. Only the light will shine, the me will remain invisible, and will and will die consummated. That is, this me I am referring to, the psychophysical organism. Do we see the body of the sun or light? To know the fact of I do not know is the healthy root for true faith. Belief empty, I am faithful. When there is no web of illusions and fixed ideas spun out by sense brain activity, pure mind shines. Now this is the divine mind at work. These are not mere words. Come clean and you will be the light. The shining of pure mind is the source of right comprehension. What comprehension, that is, whatever comprehension is permitted to us. The mystery of Krishna's revelations that the indestructible unmanifest is the abode of Him, the Supreme Person, and that He in turn is the abode of the indestructible unmanifest, is the mystery of the container and the contained. You'll find this sort of expounded in some measure in the Kabbalistic teachings. The contained becomes the container. It produces its own container. The primordial creative energy bringing forth the universe is the container of the contained. And the two are one. This is where one has to be careful. We think of containing in terms of, say, a box, and it contains other objects. There are no other objects where transcendence and manifestation are concerned. There is no otherness. And yet there is this extraordinary phenomenon of container and contained. Transcendence resists transcendence. That is to say, it produces a certain vibration. Or perhaps, if I put it this way, supposing you take one hand by the other hand, by your other hand, and pull, you see, pull them apart. That brings about a certain activity. The primordial energy, immeasurable, undifferentiated, interplays with itself, giving rise to vortices of energy, measurable because of the production of differentiation. The moment you have differentiation, you have measurement possible. If things are not different, that is to say, the differentiation is there because I, being limitedly conscious as an ordinary human being, am aware of differentiation in that way. But in holistic consciousness, there is no differentiation. And yet, the contained and the container are one and the same. You see, this thing is completely beyond brain. The brain can't grasp this kind of thing. I've tried for years and years, but it doesn't work. Cosmos appears where no cosmos was. No categories, space, time, etc., apply where the primordial is concerned. They are coterminous with cosmos. Yet cosmos and the primordial are an identity. This ancient esoteric tradition is obviously beyond intellectual grasp, but it energizes the perfectly silent-minded one in the I Am state. The I Am state, you know, as in Exodus, the Lord God says, I am that I am. It may help the unegoistic, willing learner to sense the inseparability in whole truth of the primordial and cosmos, God and man, spirit and matter. The container is the contained, and the container is the contained. Let the mind, calm and pure, remain intensely alert and restful, and it will absorb knowledge which is beyond analysis but has perfect clarity.